A few stories.
That's all right.
And some of them are true.
Well, I've heard some good ones just a few minutes ago.
Well, I'm happy to have some ladies and a few boys. But we were at Tiger yesterday and we had boys. That's not very exciting. Homely boys. Well, my name is Stan Richardson, Stanley Richardson, but I go by Stan or Hey You, whichever it can be. My wife, June, goes with me wherever I go. She's my leader and keeper. But I was a fighter pilot in World War II, and I flew P-38 Lightnings. And I'm not going to dwell too much on the technicalities of the Lightning. I want to tell you about a couple of my stories. But this is the airplane that I flew most of my missions in. That's a P-38 Lightning, and it was a premier fighter of World War II. It's my opinion that's the best propeller fighter of any country in World War II. I flew 126 sorties in the Lightning, and then I flew another 24 in the P-51 Mustang, which was also a dandy fighter. And it's the Mustang that Mark Peterson has that I flew the other day, and it brought back some great memories. The P-38 has twin engines, as you see, and it was the only airplane in this configuration of World War II, and it was unique to the American fighter force. They built 10,037 of these airplanes. There are seven remaining in the world, one at the Evergreen Museum and one at Tillamook. So Oregon has 2/7 of the remaining flyable P-38s. And we are volunteers at the museum in Minville, usually on Sunday. If you're ever down there, let me know you're going to be there, and I'll get you in free. We'll talk about airplanes, look around. And so the P-38 was my favorite for several reasons. You'll note that this 3,200 horsepower, 400-mile-an-hour airplane, and five guns in the nose. Now, what more could a 20-year-old kid want than that? So the firepower on this airplane was awesome. It had four 50-caliber machine guns. The bullet was about as big as my thumb, 50-caliber. And it had one 20-millimeter cannon, the only American fighter to have a cannon. And it was a 20-millimeter, pretty good-sized cannon. I did not use the cannon in air-to-air because the 450 caliber machine guns were bore sighted to fire within each of them in a 6-foot circle at 1,000 yards. That's almost 3/5 of a mile, way out there. And each machine gun fired about 750 rounds a minute on a good day. And we had about 750 rounds of ammunition for each gun, so about 1 minute of total firing time. That's plenty. Because you come up behind an enemy aircraft and you give him a 2-second burst, that's all it takes to knock him down. But the P-51, you see, has the guns out in the wing roots, and they were outboard of the propeller arc. You didn't want to shoot your propeller away when you pulled the trigger. So the concentration of firepower was reduced on this airplane compared to this airplane. But the armament guys, the fellas that could bore sight the guns, and they had special tools for that, they could line the guns up for maximum concentration of firepower about 300 to 400 yards out ahead of this airplane. Now, our gun sights would tell us when we were within target range, the presentation. We had several different kinds of gunfight sights, but we knew if we were up in ME-109 against the 109, for example, that's 32-foot wingspan, and about the same for the Focke-Wulf 190. So we could tell from our gun sight when we were within firing range of an airplane with 32-foot wingspan. To become a combat fighter pilot, you had to qualify 5% shooting with the machine gun. In other words, if they gave you 100 rounds in one machine gun, firing at a target, great big 6-foot target, 20 or 30 feet long, being towed by an airplane, you had to put 5% or 5 bullets out of 100 into that target. And we'd go up and fire air-to-air against the targets. And maybe today my bullets were all dipped in red paint so that when they went through the target, they left a little red mark. And the other guys would be blue paint and maybe green paint or no paint. So when the target was dropped, the guys could go out and count the number of red, blue, green, and no paint holes. And they know who was firing that paint. And we had to shoot 5% qualify. On a good day, I was able to put 8 or 9% in. Sometimes some of the guys got up to 10%. You had to have 5%. Now, when we got to England, we were still using the old-fashioned gun sight, the P-38. And then when the P-51s came along, we had what we called a no-miss-em gun sight. Now, remember, 5% on this, and I could shoot 8% on a good day. When the no-miss-em gun sight came along, it was a gyro-stabilized gun sight built by Sperry. So the gun sight, in rough air, if it was uncaged, it would bob around. But if a target went across you like that, a 109 or a 190, and you rolled in behind him, and if you're a duck hunter or a goose hunter, you know you've got to put the nose of the airplane shooting the bullets out here where the target's going to be. Not at the target, because by the time the bullets get the target you see, the target is gone. So it takes a lot of practice, and it's an artful thing to know how much to lead a target with the fixed gun sight to put the bullets in the target when he gets out here. This no-miss-em gun sight, gyro-stabilized, the pipper, as it's called, the thing that you want to put on the target to shoot him, is bobbing around out here, and as you roll into a turn, you start to pull the nose ahead, and the pipper follows. It isn't out here like it is in the P-38. It's back here because this gyro-stabilization, you have to pull that pipper up and put him on the target. Now your nose is pointing way out ahead of the target, and it's calculating where the bullets are going to be when they get on the target. Well, with that no-miss-em gun sight, we could put 90% of the bullets into a target. 90%. It got better in Korea. We had the same gun sight, and I was flying Sabres, F-86s there, and we had radar ranging. And we had a little radar in the nose that could latch onto a target, and it would tell us exactly how far that target was from us. And we had a little yellow light that came on when the target was in range. The gun sight would circle down like that, and we could set it. Our targets were going to be 32-foot wingspread MiGs, so we could set that in, and all we had to do is track that MiG for a tenth of a second, and we'd put almost 100% of the rounds in. Very effective gun sight. And that's why we were able to claim a 10-to-1 kill ratio over the MiGs. But we didn't have that early on in England, flying out of England with our American fighters. And I don't think the British ever had that during World War II. The Germans did not have that. But the German fighter pilots were pretty darn good fighter pilots, because in 1936 and 37, down in the Spanish Civil War, these fellas started flying BF-109s, which was a brand new airplane. And as they gained experience with it, the manufacturer gained experience, and the airplanes were improved, continued to be improved. And the German fighter pilots ran up some tremendous scores down there because they were more experienced than their Spanish enemy. And the airplanes, the BF-109 was a wonderful airplane. It was better than anybody else had at that time. And so those fellas flew a lot of combat hours. The Americans had to fly 200 combat hours in a tour. I flew a little more than that because I loved it. I was born to be a fighter. I loved that service. The Germans and the RCAF, the Royal Canadian Air Force, the Royal New Zealand Air Force, the Royal Australian Air Force, they had no mission limits. They were going to fly until the war ended, or they got killed. And that's the way they went home, was in a box. One of the big mistakes Hitler made, and he made a lot of them. Who is Adolf Hitler? Anybody know?
The fear of Germany.
Right. He made a lot of bad mistakes. One of them was that these German fighter pilots that survived the Spanish War should have been taken out of combat and put in the training command to train the young German fighter pilots coming along. He did not do that. In early 1943, I went operational in later 1943, the Germans owned the air over Europe. We finally cut into that by killing the ME-109s and the 190s and the German pilots flying them. So when the air war, at the end of 1944 and into 1945, we owned the air. The Germans couldn't take off and go. They'd never get from A, they'd never get to B. So we literally owned the air. An example of the inexperience of these new guys, and we could tell it in our combat tactics. Early on in my combat missions, boy, when we jumped on a German flight, or they jumped on us, we could tell from their tactics and how they flew their airplane that they were first-class combatants, and we better be dang-gum careful. Later on, that all changed. We could tell the tactics were going downhill, and their aggressiveness was going downhill. And one day, we attacked a group of German fighters sitting on the ground at Colomiers, north of Paris, and there were two 109s in the training period, in the pattern training, one behind the other on downwind leg. They were going to turn and land. We came up behind them. I came up behind them, and I shot down these two guys in about 30 seconds. And we found out later they had 10 hours total fighter time. 10 hours. It took me 10 hours to learn how to get in and out of my airplane. And these kids were trying to learn to be fighter pilots. So that's what we were up against. We cleared the sky of those German fighter pilots. A few of them survived, not very many. Eric Hartmann, the leading ace of all aces. Put this in perspective, the leading American ace was Dick Baum, and he had 40 kills, 40 confirmed kills, flying P-38s in the South Pacific. The next highest guy was Tommy McGuire, and I knew these guys. He had 38. Eric Hartmann flew all during the war, and he flew 109s, 352 kills. 40 for Dick Baum, 352 for Eric Hartmann, and there was a young chap known as the Star of Africa, and he was finally shot down by a P-38, but he had 180 kills. There were a whole flock of German fighter pilots that had between 200 and 300. Only three had 300 or above, and Eric Hartmann, of course, was the best of the bunch. But by the time the war ended, very, very few of those guys survived the war. We would have, there'd be fighter aces meetings in Washington, D.C. The surviving German fighter pilots would show up. Some American fighter jocks would show up. Some German Japanese fighter guys would show up. Now we're all buddies, you know, and we're drinking booze, smoking cigars, and telling lies, and refighting the war. But some of them survived the war. And I'll follow with another mission that I sort of get misty-eyed on. We were area support. We were not assigned a definite B-17 or a B-24 box. We were in a general area where B-24s were bombing strategic targets. And it's not usual for the escorting fighters. We were not escorting, but we were the fighters in the area down below the level of the bombers. We were sort of looking for any 109s that might be scooting around or ground targets that would be worth attacking. And we were about 15 or 20 miles from this box of bombers, and they called for help from the little friends. They could communicate with us, and we could communicate with them on our VHF radio. So they called for help, and so we turned toward their location and boogied over there with high power. And before we got there, the 109s and 190s, the single-engine fighters, and the German twin-engine fighters, which were subpar fighters, were twin-engine, 210s, 410s. They were diving down and shooting these B-24s. They shot down 23 B-24s during their attack. And when we got there, they didn't know we were down below the bombers, and we picked up 19 of those guys, shot down 19 German fighters. So I chased a 109 to the ground and shot him, and I was climbing back up to rejoin the fray, and the parachutes were everywhere. The American parachutes were just as white as that. The Germans were sort of a mottled color, very distinctive. Well, as I was climbing back up, I saw this German parachute ahead of me about 9,000 feet. And it was not my intent to run over him or shoot him or anything like that. That's not our style. I don't think Americans did that. Some of the Japanese did shoot a guy in a parachute. Anyhow, as I come up onto this guy, I just swing out to the right a little bit. I didn't want to run over him. And he's sitting in his parachute, and as I approach him, I waggle my wings a little bit, sort of in a universal hello. And as I went by this guy, he sat up straight and he gave me a big salute as I went by. Well, anyhow, I often wondered if that guy survived that. Any questions? Yes.
How do you feel about the war in Iraq right now?
I'm anti-war. Anti-war in Iraq. And I'll tell you why. First of all, I don't like you American men getting killed or American women getting killed. But we're into that war for $1 trillion now. And I'm speaking just for me. I don't represent anybody else. I'm just speaking for me. But we're into that war for $1 trillion. It's going to be $10 trillion by this is all over, because by our nature, we're going to go in and rebuild that country. Think what $1 trillion would do: breast cancer, and all of the rest of this stuff that we could have defeated. Heart problems. You put enough money in it, Alzheimer's disease. All that stuff could be defeated because we would have the money to put in it. And it's going to be $10 trillion. We could feed every hungry person in the world for $10 trillion. We could build a house for every homeless person in the world for $10 trillion. So the number one reason I'm against it, not the money, it's the humans. I don't like to see our young youth sacrificed to war. But I'm a low-level person in government. I'm not in government at all, but I can voice my opinions, which I have just done. A lot of people disagree with me. I watched the History Channel, and I watched Rumsfeld on Bill O'Reilly last night, and that idiot, they ought to fire him. And but the trouble is, we've got too many idiots. If the politicians would call all of the generals in and say, win this war in 30 days by whatever means, we could win it by whatever means in 30 days. I'm going to say something that might offend somebody. If I were in charge and I had my American troops being killed at Baghdad, I would get a message to the mullah, the head guy in Baghdad that knows everything and everybody, and I'd say, the next American that's killed in your area of influence, there will be no Baghdad. Now, we have the equipment, the military force, we have the weapons more than anybody has ever known throughout history. That's brutal, to go in there and wipe out 1 million people. But if it's to end the war, you'd only have to do it once. Because if you told the world, anybody that attacks us is going to suffer dire consequences. And if they attack us and we suffered dire consequences upon them, the word would get out, maybe we better not screw around with these Americans. Simple as that. But we're throwing this money away, killing Americans, killing Iraqis, a lot of good Iraqis dying, Iraqi young people. I don't know how anybody could ever convince me that I should strap a bomb on me and blow myself up in a meat market somewhere. I don't understand. It comes down to, I think, a religious war as much as it is anything else. I can't imagine, and I'm not a religious person, but I can't imagine anybody in my country convincing me that I should go and stand next to you and blow myself up just to kill you. I hope I haven't offended anybody. But you might want to jot down my email. I am a volunteer down at the Evergreen Museum, and I can get you in without charge if you give me a call and establish a contact. And it's very easy. P38. That's P38. No dashes. P38 Gunfighter. GUNFIGHTER at AOL.com. Now, if you should email me, and I hope you will, in the subject box, put up Tualatin High School, because I won't recognize your email, and I throw it away. I dump them. So identify yourself in the box with the Tualatin High School. That'll do it. So I'll know that you are one of the youngsters around here. And one more thing, in closing, you can do anything you want to do. You can be anything. Supreme Court Justice, Vice President of the United States, President of the United States. Honest, you can do anything you want to do, but you have to be educated to do that. You can't sit around listening to your iPod class. You've got to be educated. And if you're not educated, you're going to lose. You're not going to make it if you don't get yourself educated. Work at it. These teachers around here are not your adversaries. They're all your friends. They're on your side. They want you to learn as much as I want you to learn. But you establish a goal, as I did when I was 4 years old. I was going to be a pilot. 10 years old, I was going to be a fighter pilot. And I fulfilled my dreams. You can do the same thing. And I wish all of you good luck. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.